I must confess.
This is Bondi talking about the cosmological scene after World War II.
The medical profession
21 May 88 in Bologna.
It's very good in my organs that they don't treat themselves. But here, some of us seem to be writing our own history. And there's nothing against that, as far as I know. Secondly, let me say that I'm really giving two talks, or more properly, one and a half, because Tommy Gold was originally asked to speak, then said yes, rather later found that he couldn't. And so I will give largely my talk, which was intended to be on the background, on the scene in which the steady state theory was born, and then follow really with my reminiscences of how it was born. In starting here, I think I want to follow directly on Osterbrook's talk and at what McCrae said just now. The figure of Hubbard was certainly more than life science, and I think quite rightly so. What he had done in establishing that one could talk sensibly about the spiral nebulae, in showing against von Manen, who to my mind got off very lightly in the discussions here so far, that these were indeed galaxies much like our own, in putting Slipher's work on an enormously extended basis, he really did a wonderful amount to found and get going the whole subject. This enormous prestige, I think more, and here I differ a little from McCrae, than Eddington's calculations, gave a great sanctity to his 1.8 times 10 to the 9th years as the inverse Hubble constant. Again, I think a name that should be mentioned is Arthur Holmes of Newcastle, who as the first person really did something to establish the age of the rocks. And this led to the great problems which were oppressing us all. You must of course remember that those of us led by Einstein who rejected the cosmic had to deal not with 1.8 times 10 to the 9th years, but with a shorter time, because with gravitation slowing down expansion, it must have been faster in the past. With the simplest of all models, the Einstein decider, it would have been 1.2 times 10 to the 9th years. And the conflict was gross. Secondly, the mention of the work of Eddington, but particularly of Milne and of Dirac, showed that cosmology was ripe for imaginative ideas, ripe for something to bring order to this. Again, if I may add a little bit to what McCrae said, I think it is Milne's pugnaciousness and his unwillingness to have people swallow other than the whole of his theory that it makes us all give him less credit than he really deserves. First, for inventing the radar method of measuring distances years before radar became public property, and 2.5 decades before that became the method of establishing distances on the Earth and in the solar system, and so the foundation of everything. And although in cosmological terms, the times are absurdly large, as a principle of how one brings distance in, as a principle that one can do without the rigid rod, that, as many of you know, I found this immensely valuable in clarifying and explaining the concepts of special gravity. Secondly, this idea that there might be different timescales. still seems to me one of the most imaginative ideas of my time. True, we have not found a sound application for it so far. But the idea that different clocks might register different times is a profound idea. And I think even if it turns out not to be so, it is one that I think deserves more discussion than it has. The attitudes that have been discussed at the time, or also a certain amount of the man whose name has not been mentioned here, Otto Heckmann. He wrote a magnificent book on cosmology that, because of the war and the difficulties of getting anything across after it, has not received anything like the credit it deserves. He was a magnificent person, and it was a very good book. And when people say kind things about my book, I would very much want to say that I owe a great deal to him. Let me then come to various of the other ideas. It was, of course, Lemaître who first put the real physics into cosmology. And the question which was then beginning to be insistently present was the question of the origin of the universe. And again, it's interesting how the different things work together. In the early days of astrophysics, and at the time still when Eddington was writing his internal constitution of the stars, the dominance of hydrogen helium was not appreciated at all. And if all elements are present in large amounts, there is much less reason to try to trace everything back to hydrogen. And so, it was that simultaneous movement of Lemaître seeing in cosmology something about the origin of the elements and the importance of hydrogen through the work of Hoyle and others and Lecrae, who did the first model of a very largely hydrogenic star. I think it was one of your early papers, I think. That very gradually led to an appreciation of this situation where the spice of heavy elements called for an explanation. And of course, Gamow, as has been said, came in at the time. Now, for once, I have some notes. So, another item that became significant at the time was worries about general relativity. Nobody said anything in public, but nobody's putting it too strongly, few said anything in public. But the great majority of physicists thought this was an obscure backwater, which took an awful lot of learning to get into it. And if I put now my strong personal bias into it, I don't think the way either Einstein or Eddington or Weil or others presented was sufficiently physical for the common or garden physicists to see how logically, inevitably, it followed from Galileo's principle that all bodies fall into us. And so, general relativity was a bit on the back burner. The only thing that pushed it forward at that time was when it was thought to have a unique ability to account for a universe with a universal recession. Milne, of course, never liked it at all, and he and then Milne and Lecrae did a great work on Newtonian cosmology. Now, to me, one of the most interesting features of this was that the reason it hadn't been done 50 or 100 years earlier was purely people had this preconception of the static universe totally fixed in their minds. The mathematical and physical apparatus for it was available long before. But until the 1920s, nobody, certainly until De Sitter's paper, I should say, nobody took the idea of a universe in a state of motion, any state of motion, as anything it was worth spending 5 minutes on. So, again, let me say that it was Hoyle who brought Gould and me into astronomical questions, into dozens of astronomical questions. And was his inspiration, first when we were all working for the Admiralty during the war, then when we were all together in Cambridge, that brought both of us into this subject at all. And we discussed everything from morning to night, amongst other things, the timescale problem and the very severe worry it gave us, our appreciation that there was the Lemaître Eddy model, a considerable dislike for it. A, because it seemed to be a bit of a fiddle. I mean, to imagine that the universe is just above, that the lambda is just above the critical value, and that it had this long dwell time. It really didn't look all that attractive. And then the whole question of the thermodynamics of it. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. It was, as I think is now historically well known, Gould's idea that there might be this process of continual creation that allowed a steady state to go, and that Fred and I said, Bach will disprove this before dinner. Well, dinner was a little late that night. And before very long, we all saw that this was a perfectly possible solution to the question. Then, Fred on the one hand and Tommy and I on the other went somewhat different ways. He much more in the field-theoretical direction of putting in his creation field, we in a much more philosophical direction. Again, it's worth mentioning the kind of trouble we had in those days, because it shows how minds change. At that time, for both his side and outside, people were not necessarily quite so shocked by the idea of continual creation as by the question of how would the newly created matter know with what velocity to move. And it is my impression that nobody had seriously taken a board at the time, that the universe was not Lorentzian level, and that isotropy defined a preferred velocity at every point, namely that from which the universe looked isotropic. And we had a lot of argument and nobody liked. Of course, with the observations of the day, that velocity was only very vaguely defined. And it needed, 20 years later, the discovery of the microwave background. Now, everybody knows this, that there is a preferred velocity. Though few people, I think, if I may boast, are quite as logical as I, who say that the principle of special relativity now can really only be properly phrased as the universe provides a preferred velocity at every point. To date, nobody has devised a laboratory experiment to reveal this.
This is not true.
Who?
There is a man behind the universe.
When was that?
This is Einstein. There is a lab. I know. So many years. Einstein never measured.
I'm sorry.
He has measured. And only to continue. No, nobody has measured. All
right. In any case, it's common property now. Again, let me discuss a little more the philosophical attitude and the ironies of the situation of the day. The idea certainly came first, the philosophy came afterwards. But the idea, the notion, that if the universe was evolving and changing, then there was no reason to trust that we, what we now call the laws of physics, had permanent validity, that impressed us very strongly. Of course, it was easy for us to be greatly impressed. That is what Dirac had said. That it was Milne that said within two time scales. But the validity of this criticism, of any evolving model, struck us then as of the utmost importance. Not in saying that's what the universe must be like, but that in any evolving model must handle this question, why is it that this is regarded as conserved and permanent and not that? And I think this is what worries me about all the modern developments in the Big Bang model, including, of course, the inflationary side. It is an extrapolation of our knowledge into incredibly different conditions. What goes with this, and I'm perhaps slightly more philosophical than I originally intended to be, but I'll give myself a few more minutes. The Lyell, the geologist, has been mentioned in our meeting yesterday, I think. And you remember the phrase with which he revolutionized geology 150 or 160 years ago was the present is the key to the past. Meaning that it is processes we now see here and now that must be used to account for the formation of the rocks of the earth. Now it is to me, and has been, with one little exception to which I will come, it has been to me all the time the essential idea that we can tell anything about the universe only because it is in interaction with us. That interaction conditions things here today. Mass principle, our inertia is due to the universe. The Olbers situation, our thermodynamics is due to the universe. And whichever resolution of Olbers' paradox is taken, in any such resolution, the universe has everything to do with what we observe here and now. The more modern observation of the microwave background, that we are in a heat bath of 2.8 degrees or whichever. That is the kind of observation and the kind of background that it seems to me is a much better test of cosmologies than anything else. And Gold wanted me particularly to stress that he feels still on these grounds very critical of what has been done in evolving models, because it does not discuss these options, these possibilities enough, even where they are denied. I said there was irony in my attitude in this. When Fred was publishing this paper, Gould and I were left a little high and dry, because there was this idea, there was our philosophy was beginning to form, where you can't publish a paper in physics or astronomy on an idea and a little bit of philosophy. And the key to publication came when I noticed that Hubble's number patterns, with his constant, lent themselves, so it seemed, very well to being accounted for by the steady state model. And that is the pick on which our publication was initially had. I wasn't yet as worried about observations of great distances then as I later became, but it still, I find it rather amusing that it wasn't the thermodynamics that led to publication, it wasn't in our writing, but the Hubble number counts. Of course, the number of people who found the theory attractive was relatively small, where of course Irwin Craig was perhaps the first. The number of people who took it quite seriously was very large. And they generally didn't like it. And in the many discussions I had, what I always threw at them was, if the universe had ever been in a very different state from what it is now, show me some fossil remains of what it was a long time ago. The only fossil remains that anybody could possibly think of at the time were the heavy elements. And this, and I think it's a paper that has perhaps not been mentioned enough, in the early 50s, Saul Peter showed that in fact the Gamow model would not produce any elements higher than helium, with the exception perhaps of lithium. And then of course came the great work that I regard as the full justification of the steady state theory, when Hoyle and the Burbages and Fowler gave us our modern nuclear synthesis. The fact that steady state inspires is to me an ample justification. I must say that at this stage there was a fossil that I was beginning to be worried about. And that fossil was the amount of helium. And I remember in particular pestering Andrew McKellar, who was then the astronomer most involved in looking for elements like helium, to see whether one could or could not get to a good estimate. And the fact that we do seem to have a good deal more helium about than corresponds to starlight, that is just the kind of evidence that to me is important in cosmology. Now it may be accounted for otherwise, of course, but this, what is here and now in helium, seemed to me then, as it still does now, to be a key question in understanding whether the universe was ever there. We are pretty sure that we don't owe the condensations to the Big Bang. We are certain we don't know owe the heavy elements to the Big Bang. We may owe the helium to the Big Bang, and we, that is the standard interpretation, has a great deal to be said for it. And then, of course, while I'd foreseen the helium problem, I'd not in any way foreseen the microwave pattern. And then we come to the point that this is very readily interpreted as a fossil from those days. So my crying out for fossils has had an answer, and I think that is still very important. Let me finish by saying a word or two more about the timescale problem and how it affected our thinking. With steady state, of course, the average age of any object is only a third of the Hubble cost. So that if we wanted to say our galaxy was much older than the average, that looked at first sight a very unattractive proposition. But what is often forgotten is that with the Hubble distance scale, ours was an enormous galaxy. I remember somebody said at the time, with Hubble's measurements, whereas the other galaxies are islands, ours is a continent. can't remember who said it, I don't know whether you recall, but you recall the saying. And so it was not just in order to fit the age of the rocks into the time scale that we said that our galaxy was very old. All you have to assume that galaxies grow, and that one blow, its exceptional size and its exceptional age, fitted together. I think that is really all I wanted to say. On the philosophical side, I think the person from whom we had most help was Popper's analysis of science, which encouraged one to be imaginative, encouraged one to go for something that was very rigid and disprovable. He always gave preference to the more testable theories. And against that, of course, we saw, certainly in those days, and I think to some extent still today, that an evolving universe model can always explain almost any result by saying, well, that's just the evolution of the galaxies, or something, you don't have to ascribe it geometry. And the fact that this is not available in space makes it such a testable theory. Of course, it's the natural fate of testable theories to be disproved. That is what science is all about. But it is much better to be testable than to be non-testable. I always tell my students that my weather forecast for tomorrow is it'll be wet or dry, warm or cold, cloudy or fair. You won't be able to disprove it, but I haven't helped you a lot. And so we were proud of the rigidity of the theory and the fact that it could be tested. Of course, these are years long ago. Let me finish with a remark that relates to McCrae's final point and pat myself just a little on the back. When he regretted the great people, whom I think he should have added in a slightly different context, Schrödinger, who spent so many years of their lives digging away in a particular direction where nobody was following them at the time, and nobody has followed them since, which is why they regard as fruitless. One shouldn't keep hacking away at things for too long, particularly if nobody's with them. I can proudly say I haven't written a paper on cosmology for well over 3 decades.
This is North.
My point is simply that cosmology is not only created by the interaction between the cosmologists and the universe, but by the interaction between cosmologists and other cosmologists. And this is really a warning to historians who might consider that because an idea was published, and therefore it was somehow in the public domain and capable of influencing our people. I was particularly reminded of this during this morning session when there were a lot of wonderful ideas, but not very influential ones perhaps. This is not for me to decide. I'm simply drawing attention to the possibility. You mentioned a case which is a very good example of danger in this, and that is Heckmann's book. Heckmann's book has now been, I think, reprinted by Schrödinger, and anybody can buy it. If you're not one, that is. when I was writing my history of cosmology about 20 odd years ago, and Asia. In fact, it was almost impossible to find a copy in England. Eventually, I don't know why, you know, that's not to say. But there is just an example of a danger. This is where the problem is here. Might be some use.
May I just respond briefly? That in various of my jobs, I saw a good deal of security for technical matters in military and industrial affairs. And I was always astonished at the need for this, because it's so difficult to get any idea across.
I wonder if I might make a comment. I'm slightly worried about the advice that both Bill McRae and Herman Bondi have given you all, not to hack away for years and years and years, because I do have to remind you that in discovering general relativity, Einstein hacked away for at least 9 years with nobody else supporting him.
9 years!
So it's when you're successful that you're not successful.
No. 10 years a decade I would regard as tolerant. 20 years when it begins to be bad. Okay.
Yes.
Just a brief comment on Heckman's book. It actually was that book that Hank Vonderhelst read as a graduate student and then based his first tie-in of radio astronomy and cosmology in 1944.
Any other? Bill, do you want to come in?
No, but I have a question. It's a purely historical one, and somebody here may know the answer. I thought it was Einstein himself who got radar distance. I don't know whether Professor Ehlers remembers. Did Einstein invent radar distance? I thought he did.
I don't now recall a particular place, but I do remember that the mathematician Konstantin Karl Theodori in Göttingen made an axiomatics of special relativity where he used optical means solely and where he emphasized that the concept of distance should be considered as a derived concept, derived in fact from radar reflections. That was a little known way of
saying. I never heard of it until now. If you can give me a reference, I certainly learned it from him. Who did not give a reference?
Mel didn't give a reference. Yeah. No. But it went to Katia Dori, might very well have done it because he did all sorts of remarkable things.
Yes. Well, he axiomatized thermodynamics and made it quite unrecognizable. Any other?
Very deep.
Yes, Paul.
I was just wondering if you were you aware at the time of Alfred and Herman's prediction of the microwave background temperature?
No.
At that time?
No.
No.
No need for security.
No need for security.
Well, perhaps we should stop now because we must keep some eye on the time.
That ends Bondi's talk at the Bologna Conference on Modern Cosmology in Retrospect on 21 May 1988.